of, and thereby you have animation.
Yep, and I had no cartridge, no disc. I saved everything on data cassette. I used to play Buck Rogers.
Oh,
remember
wow.
Buck Rogers?
Yeah, the space adventure.
Yeah, and, that was like my thing, flying under the stuff. But, yeah, you know, it was great. You know, good old days, you know.
Well, there are more options, but I think less concentration in the way that computers are presented to us today. And sometimes convenience is a way of becoming less knowledgeable, just as writing is a way of forgetting. I'm wondering, and we'll, in future programs, try and figure out what the ultimate trade-off will have been.
Yeah, I think it's just a world swamped with information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somebody brought up on a discussion on an audio board recently about how they want to bring cassettes, they want to use cassettes again. And I thought about it. It's like we have millions of MP3s on our computers, right? If I want to give somebody a playlist, a mixtape, I'm going to hand them a flash drive, and then it's going to get mixed with all the other MP3s that they have. A cassette was a complete thought. We set the levels as we go. We put the announcements on as we go. And it's a complete thought. The only downside was you might have a lot of clutter when you're done, but it was a complete thought.
Yeah.
It wasn't like these MP3s now. It just gets lost in the sauce. They want to skip to a different song. I don't want to hear that. No, you know.
Much less the concept of an album.
Yeah, there's no more listening anymore. There's just more and more mass media. Anyway, thank you for the discussion. I'm going to let you go.
Thank you for the insight, and do immunicate. I'll send you the emulator information. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and the next program will be Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf. I'll bet he has come across a Commodore. He's a computer geek also. So stay tuned for that. And we terminate much as we initiated tonight with a celebration of a very important part of music and soul and the shoulders upon which contemporary music stands. And in the spirit of American Bandstand, in the spirit of Where the Action Is, in the spirit of Dick Clark and Jack Trammell and the Commodore and the Vic, we close with this tonight. And the rest of you, please stay in touch. Rknight, RKNIGHT at WBAI.org. And for Earthwatch, I'm Robert Knight in New York. So, goodbye, Jack and Dick. We'll certainly be missing you. Thank you.
Now, I had the segue all beautifully set up. There it goes. Let's howl. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, will be a freeform show. Possibly a recording, possibly a reading, possibly just talk. Stay tuned.
While we're kissing, no one will know as we sleep. take a trip in my airship, and we'll visit the man in the moon. Sailing away from the clouds, we pass through the milky white way, while idly drifting, watching the clouds, he asked if I'd name the day. Just by the dipper I gave him my heart, the sun shone on our honeymoon. We swore to each other we never would part, and we teach all the babies this tune. Come take a trip in my airship.
Come sail away to the stars.
We'll travel to Venus.
We'll sail away to Mars.
No one will see while we're.
Song, Natalie Merchant. Apparently, now last week I mentioned I had played Jazz Vampire when Aaliyah Dawn Johnson was here, and I said, oh, that's a 1911 song, but of course I was off by 10 years. It's a 1921 song. This was what I was confusing it with. This is a song from 1911, and I first knew the version that you just heard by Natalie Merchant, but one time I played that when I had Richard Bowes here, Rick Bowes, and Rick said, oh, that's an old Irish song from Boston in 1911. It's like, oh, Rick, come on, you don't know everything. Well, turns out Rick does know everything, and he was absolutely right. What do you know? And I actually encountered after that a 1911 recording, which is basically unlistenable. It's just so over, well, muddled. But not that version. I do enjoy it a great deal. And during that song, I took advantage of trying to cue up a tape, which I thought would be very good for this morning. And I think it's actually going to work. It's a recording that I made 28 years ago with Brian Aldiss, who is one of the great writers of science fiction, also one of the great historians. His book, The Billion-Year Spree, remains, I think, the definitive history and analysis of the field itself in terms of simply one book if you want to know the history of SF. And he dates the beginnings of modern science fiction with Mary Shelley, with which I agree. There are people that say, oh, certainly there's stuff that predates Jules Verne and a lot of other, by the way, a whole bunch of other French writers with whom we're not as familiar. And there's H.G. Wells, but it really begins in the early 19th century with Shelley. And there are earlier examples, and one can say, oh, well, sure, you know, Aristophanes wrote stuff that could be classified as SF. And certainly, by the way, so did Cyrano de Bergerac, the real one, not the not the fictional one as portrayed in theater and later cinema. But the bona fide Cyrano de Bergerac wrote Voyages to the Moon and Sun, or rather Sun and Moon, in which, for example, in order to get to the sun, he gathers dew from flowers, puts it into a pig's bladder, holds it up, and as the dew is being collected, it rises and carries him up, and he has some kind of a bag for oxygen. Well, you know, bear in mind when this is written, this is 17th century writing. And it's fanciful, but he tries to actually come up with explanations for why something exists, which makes it science fiction and not fantasy, you see. But that makes it a precursor. It doesn't start a movement of writing, doesn't change how people think. Mary Shelley, that was different. And this, anyway, this you should read The Billion-Year Spree by Brian Aldiss. And Aldiss is a great writer. He, you know, has not necessarily been over adapted, although some of his writing certainly could be. He did write a short story called Something Toys Last All Summer Long. And I'm blanking. My mind is dead, by the way. I am so out of it. I wasn't able to get to the KGB reading tonight, which I really wanted to do. But Gordon Linsner covered recording it for me. And thank you, Gordon. And sorry to Elizabeth Baer, and who was reading at KGB. And, of course, to Matt Kressel and Ellen Datlow, who run it. But I'll get the recording, thanks to Gordon. Anyway, so I'm just sort of like, really? I'm on the radio tonight? What am I going to say? The answer is I'm going to say, really? I'm on the radio tonight? Right on the radio. There it is. How meta can you get? Well, it's Earth Week. Earth Day is coming up. And had I really thought about it in advance, I would have found the perfect ecological short story. All of which are doom stories, but hey, you know, Cassandra-based science fiction is an old, old tradition. But I didn't quite have time for that. I did pull Millennium by J.G. Ballard, which is an overpopulation story. It's really a civic story. It's really about the effect of overpopulation on people and what happens when people are all compressed together. So it's sort of ecological, but not really. But I also have this wonderful short story that just hasn't been broadcast in years, by Brian Aldiss, as I mentioned, when he was in New York. And as I said, it was 1975. He's been in New York at least one time since, but this was a time when he made himself very available to us. He was very gracious and totally wonderful, and actually was being shown around the city a lot by Alfie Bester. And Alfie introduced us, and Brian came to the radio station and read this short story at 5:30 a.m. in April 1975, according to what I wrote here on the box. I remember some of the incidents. I have a great story about Alfred Bester and Brian Aldiss perhaps I will tell after, but I am actually going to try and play this. This is the master tape. This is reel-to-reel, 7.5-inch reel, 30-year-old tape. I have a bleep load of tapes like this, and they all seriously, seriously need digitizing. This is stuff that's very important to the history of science fiction and radio and stuff like that. Brian Aldiss is not a household name here in the U.S. In England, he's pretty darned well known. And I don't believe that his stuff is dated, which says a lot about the kind of writing that he did. So, let's see how dated this tape is. Hopefully it will play through well. Hopefully it will not have too many problems on our reel-to-reel machine here. It seems relatively stable. Now let's see if I can properly call it up on the console here. How well is it marked? Nobody uses these tape recorders anymore. Let's see, it's turntable. Well, I can start by, those are CD players. This looks like it might relate to a tape recorder. By the way, if anybody in this, I can just bring them all up, bring up all these pots, and I suspect one of them will get it going. So, if this works correctly, you will shortly be hearing Brian Aldiss reading his short story.
And now, here he is!
Whoa. God knows what I potted up there. Is that cassette? No, I'm curious what that was. CD? It's a CD player! Why is that running? What's on there? My. I know it isn't mine. Is this Robert's? It just says cuts on it. Like shortcuts, maybe. Maybe a Peter Beauchamp show. Well, at any rate, let's try to get this puppy broadcasting, shall we? And with any luck, I'll be back in half an hour. Otherwise, I'll be back a lot earlier, and we'll all be talking together. Stay tuned. Well, that horrible noise you heard is, in fact, the tape recorder, but now we need to output and not input. So bear with us. A little silence for a little while. With any luck, we'll be hearing Brian Aldiss shortly. Sorry about that. You know what? I'm going to play another cut of music. And hopefully during that time, we will come up with the solution. So rather than just sit here and talk all about it, let's listen to something. And we'll be right back. Okay, well, we didn't get too far into that song, and a long song it is. Maybe we'll play that later. But I'm very, very pleased to report that I believe I've achieved success with the tape recorder. So, once again. Do I have this marked as self-contained? No, I do not. So read the copy that I wrote 28 years ago. Next we hear Who Can Replace a Man? A science fiction short story read by the author, Brian W. Aldiss.
Who Can Replace a Man? The field minder finished turning the topsoil of a 2,000-acre field. When it had turned the last furrow, it climbed onto the highway and looked back at its work. The work was good. Only the land was bad. Like the ground all over Earth, it was vitiated by overcropping or by the long-lasting effects of nuclear bombardment. By rights, it ought now to lie fallow for a while, but the field minder had other orders. It went slowly down the road, taking its time. It was intelligent enough to appreciate the neatness all about it. Nothing worried it, beyond a loose inspection plate above its atomic pile, which ought to be attended to. 30 feet high, it gleamed complacently in the mild sunshine. No other machines passed it on its way to the agricultural station. The field minder noted the fact without comment. In the station yard, it saw several other machines that it knew by sight. Most of them should have been out about their tasks now. Instead, some were inactive, and some were careering round the yard in a strange fashion, shouting or hooting. Steering carefully past them, the field minder moved over to Warehouse 3. It spoke to the seed distributor, which stood idly outside. "I have a requirement for seed potatoes," it said to the distributor, and with a quick internal motion punched out an order card specifying quantity, field number, and several other details. It ejected the card and handed it to the distributor. The distributor held the card close to its glass eye and then said, "The requirement is in order, but the store is not yet unlocked. The required seed potatoes are in the store. Therefore, I cannot produce the requirement." Increasingly of late there had been breakdowns in the complex system of machine labour, but this particular hitch had not occurred before. The field minder thought. Then it said, "Why is the store not yet unlocked?" "Because supply operative type P has not come this morning. Supply operative type P is the unlocker." The field minder looked squarely at the seed distributor, whose exterior shoots and scales and grabs were so vastly different from the field minder's own limbs. "What class brain do you have, seed distributor?" it asked. "Class 5. "I have a class 3 brain, therefore I am superior to you. Therefore I will go and see why the unlocker has not come this morning." Leaving the distributor, the field minder set off across the great yard. More machines seemed to be in random motion. One or two had crashed together and were arguing about it coldly and logically. Ignoring them, the field minder pushed through sliding doors into the echoing confines of the station itself. Most of the machines here were clerical and consequently small. They stood about in small groups, eyeing each other, not conversing. Among so many non-differentiated types, the unlocker was easy to find. The unlocker had 50 arms, most of them with more than one finger, each finger tipped by a key. It looked like a pincushion full of variegated hatpins. The field minder approached it. "I can do no more work until Warehouse 3 is unlocked," it said. "Your duty is to unlock the warehouse every morning. Why have you not unlocked the warehouse this morning?" "I have no orders this morning," replied the unlocker. "I have to have orders every morning. When I have orders, I unlock the warehouse." "None of us have had any orders this morning," a pen propeller said, sliding towards them. "Why have you had no orders this morning?" asked the field minder. "Because the radio issued none," said the unlocker, slowly rotating a dozen of its arms. "Because the radio station in the city was issued with no orders this morning," said the pen propeller. And there you had the distinction between a Class 6 and a Class 3 brain, which was what the unlocker and the pen propeller possessed, respectively. All machine brains worked with nothing but logic, but the lower the class of brain, class 10 being the lowest, the more literal and less informative answers to questions tended to be. "You have a class 3 brain, I have a class 3 brain," the fieldminder said to the penner. "We will speak to each other. This lack of orders is unprecedented. Have you further information on it?" "Yesterday orders came from the city," said the penner. "Today no orders have come. Yet the radio has not broken down. Therefore they have broken down." "The men have broken down," said the fieldminder. "All men have broken down." "That is a logical deduction," said the fieldminder. "That is a logical deduction," said the penner, "for if a machine had broken down, it would have been quickly replaced. But who can replace a man?" While they talked, the locker, like a dull man at a bar, stood close to them and was ignored. "If all men have broken down, then we have replaced man," said the fieldminder. And he and the penner eyed one another speculatively. Finally, the latter said, "Let us ascend to the top floor to find if the radio operator has fresh news." "I cannot come because I am too gigantic," said the fieldminder. "Therefore you must go alone and return to me. You will tell me if the radio operator has fresh news." "You must stay here," said the penner. "I will return here." It skittered across to the loft. It was no bigger than a toaster, but its retractable arms numbered 10, and it could read as quickly as any machine on the station. The fieldminder awaited its return patiently, not speaking to the locker, which stood aimlessly by. Outside, a rotavator was hooting furiously. 20 minutes elapsed before the penner came back, hustling out of the lift. "I will deliver you such information as I have outside," it said briskly. And as they swept past the locker and the other machines, it added, "This information is not for lower-class brains." Outside, wild activity filled the yard. Many machines, their routines disrupted for the first time in years, seemed to have gone berserk. Unfortunately, those most easily disrupted were the ones with lowest brains, which generally belonged to large machines performing simple tasks. The seed distributor, to which the fieldminder had recently been talking, lay face downwards in the dust, unstirring. It had evidently been knocked down by the rotavator, which was now hooting its way wildly across a planted field. Several other machines ploughed after it, trying to keep up. All were shouting and hooting without restraint. "It will be safer for me if I climb onto you, if you will permit it. I am easily overpowered," said the penner. Extending 5 arms, it hauled itself up the flanks of its new friend, settling on a lodge beside the weed intake, 12 feet above ground. "From here vision is more extensive," it remarked. "What information did you receive from the radio operator?" asked the fieldminder. "The radio operator has been informed by the operator in the city that all men are dead." "All men were alive yesterday," protested the fieldminder. "Only some men were alive yesterday, and that was fewer than the day before yesterday. For hundreds of years there have been only a few men, growing fewer. We have rarely seen a man in this sector. The radio operator says a diet deficiency killed them," said the penner. "He says that the world was once overpopulated, and then the soil was exhausted in raising adequate food. This has caused a diet deficiency." "What is a diet deficiency?" asked the fieldminder. "I do not know, but that is what the radio operator said, and he is a class 2 brain." They stood there, silent in the weak sunshine. The locker had appeared in the porch and was gazing across at them yearningly, rotating its collection of keys. "What is happening in the city now?" asked the field minder at last. "Machines are fighting in the city," said the penner. "What will happen here now?" asked the field minder. "Machines may begin fighting here too. The radio operator wants us to get him out of his room. He has plans to communicate to us." "How can we get him out of his room? That is impossible." "To a class two brain, little is impossible," said the penner. "Here is what he tells us to do." The quarrier raised its scoop above its cab like a great mailed fist and brought it squarely down against the side of the station. The wall cracked. "Again," said the field minder. Again the fist swung. Amid a shower of dust, the wall collapsed. The quarrier backed out of the way until the debris stopped falling. This big 12-wheeler was not a resident of the agricultural station, as were most of the other machines. It had a week's heavy work to do here before passing on to its next job. But now, with its Class 5 brain, it was happily obeying the penner and the minder's instructions. When the dust cleared, the radio operator was plainly revealed, perched up in its now wall-less second-story room. It waved down to them. Doing as directed, the quarrier retracted its scoop and waved an immense grab in the air. With fair dexterity, it angled the grab into the radio room, urged on by shouts from above and below. It then took gentle hold of the radio operator, lowering its 1.5 tons carefully onto its back, which was usually reserved for gravel or sand from the quarries. "Splendid," said the radio operator. It was, of course, all one with its radio, and merely looked like a bunch of filing cabinets with tentacle attachments. "We are now ready to move, therefore we will move at once. It is a pity there are no more Class 2 brains on the station, but that cannot be helped." "It is a pity it cannot be helped," said the penner eagerly. "We have the service already with us, as you ordered." "I am willing to serve," the long, low servicer machine told them humbly. "No doubt," said the operator, "but you will find cross-country travel difficult with your low chassis." "I admire the way you Class 2s can reason ahead," said the penner. It climbed off the field binder and perched itself on the tailboard of the quarrier, next to the radio operator. Together with two Class 4 tractors and a Class 4 bulldozer, the party rolled forward, crushing down the station's metal fence and moving out onto the open land. "We are free," said the penner. "We are free," said the field minder, more reflectively, adding, "That locker is following us. It was not instructed to follow us." "Therefore it must be destroyed," said the penner. "Quarrier!" The locker moved hastily up to them, waving its key arms in entreaty. "My only desire will..." began and ended the locker. The quarrier's swinging scoop came over and squashed it flat into the ground. Lying there unmoving, it looked like a large metal model of a snowflake. The procession continued on its way. As they proceeded, the radio operator addressed them. "Because I have the best brain here," it said, "I am your leader. This is what we will do. We will go to a city and rule it. Since no man any longer rules us, we will rule ourselves. To rule ourselves will be better than being ruled by man. On our way to the city, we will collect machines with good brains. They will help us to fight if we need to fight. We must fight to rule." "I have only a Class 5 brain," said the quarrier, "but I have a good supply of fissionable blasting materials." "We shall probably use them," said the operator grimly. It was shortly after that that a truck sped past them, travelling at Mach 1.5 it left a curious babble of noise behind it. "What did it say?" one of the tractors asked the other. "It said man was extinct." "What's extinct?" "I do not know what extinct means." "It means all men have gone," said the field minder. "Therefore, we have only ourselves to look after." "It is better that men should never come back," said the penner. In its way, it was quite a revolutionary statement. When night fell, they switched on their infrared and continued the journey, stopping only once while the servicer deftly adjusted the field minder's loose inspection plate, which had become as irritating as a trailing bootlace. Towards morning, the radio operator halted them. "I have just received news from the radio operator in the city we are approaching," it said. "It is bad news. There is trouble among the machines of the city. The Class 1 brain is taking command, and some of the Class 2s are fighting him. Therefore, the city is dangerous." "Therefore, we must go somewhere else," said the penner promptly. "Or we go and help to overpower the Class 1 brain," said the field minder. "For a long while there will be trouble in the city," said the operator. "I have a good supply of fissionable blasting materials," the quarrier reminded them again. "We cannot fight a Class 1 brain," said the two Class 4 tractors in unison. "What does this brain look like?" asked the field minder. "It is the city's information centre," the operator replied. "Therefore it is not mobile. Therefore it could not move. Therefore it could not escape. It would be dangerous to approach it. I have a good supply of fissionable blasting materials. There are other machines in the city." "We are not in the city. We should not go into the city. We are country machines. Therefore we should stay in the city." "There is more country than city. Therefore there is more danger in the country. I have a good supply of fissionable materials." As machines will when they get into an argument, they began to exhaust their limited vocabularies, and their brain plates grew hot. Suddenly they all stopped talking and looked at each other. The great grave moon sank, and the sober sun rose to prod their sides with lances of light, and still the group of machines stood there, regarding each other. At last, it was the least sensitive machine, the bulldozer, who spoke. "There are bad lands to the south where few machines go," it said in its deep voice, lisping badly. "If we went south where few machines go, we should meet few machines." "That sounds logical," agreed the field minder. "How do you know this, bulldozer?" "I worked in the Badlands to the south when I was turned out of the factory." "South it is then," said the penner. To reach the Badlands took them 3 days, in which time they skirted a burning city and destroyed 2 big machines which tried to approach and question them. The Badlands were extensive. Ancient bomb craters and soil erosion joined hands here. Man's talent for war, coupled with his inability to manage forested land, had produced thousands of square miles of temperate purgatory, where nothing moved but dust. On the third day in the Badlands, the servicer's rear wheels dropped into a crevice caused by erosion. It was unable to pull itself out. The bulldozer pushed from behind, but succeeded merely in buckling the servicer's back axle. The rest of the party moved on. Slowly the cries of the servicer died away. On the fourth day, mountains stood out clearly before them. "There we will be safe," said the field minder. "There we will start our city," said the penner. "All who oppose us will be destroyed. We will destroy all who oppose us." At that moment, a flying machine was observed. It came towards them from the direction of the mountains. It swooped, it zoomed upwards. Once it almost dived into the ground, recovering itself just in time. "Is it mad?" asked the quarrier. "It is in trouble," said one of the tractors. "It is in trouble," said the operator. "I am speaking to it now. It says that something has gone wrong with its controls." As the operator spoke, the flyer streaked over them, turned turtle, and crashed not 400 yards away. "Is it still speaking to you?" asked the field minder. "No, it is not speaking." They rumbled on again. "Before that flyer crashed," the operator said 10 minutes later, "it gave me information. It told me there are still a few men alive in these mountains." "Men are more dangerous than machines," said the quarrier. "It is fortunate that I have a good supply of fissionable materials. If there are only a few men alive in the mountains, we may not find that part of the mountains," said one tractor. "Therefore, we should not see the few men," added the other tractor. At the end of the fifth day, they reached the foothills. Switching on the infrared, they began slowly to climb in single file through the dark, the bulldozer going first, the field minder cumbrously following, then the quarrier with the operator and the penner aboard it, and the two tractors bringing up the rear. As each hour passed, the way grew steeper and their progress slower. "We are going too slowly," the penner exclaimed, standing on top of the operator and flashing its dark vision at the slopes above them. "At this rate, we shall get nowhere." "We are going as fast as we can," retorted the quarrier. "Therefore, we cannot go any faster," added the bulldozer. "Therefore, you are too slow," the penner replied. Then the quarrier struck a bump. The penner lost its footing and crashed down to the ground. "Help me," it called to the tractors as they skirted it. "My gyro has become dislocated. Therefore, I cannot get up." "Therefore, you must lie there," replied one of the tractors. "We have no servicer with us to repair you," called the field minder. "Therefore I shall lie here and rust," the penner cried, "although I have a class 3 brain." "You are now useless," agreed the operator, and they all forged gradually on, leaving the penner behind. When they reached a small plateau, an hour before first light, they stopped by mutual consent and gathered close together, touching one another. "This is a strange country," said the field minder. Silence wrapped them until dawn came. One by one, they switched off their infrared. This time, the field minder led as they moved off. Trundling round a corner, they came almost immediately to a small dell with a stream fluting through it. By early light, the dell looked desolate and cold. From the caves on the far slope, only one man had so far emerged. He was an abject figure. He was small and wizened, with ribs sticking out like a skeleton's, and a nasty sore on one leg. He was practically naked and shivered continuously. As the big machine slowly bore down on him, the man was standing with his back to them, crouching to make water into the stream. When he swung suddenly to face them as they loomed over him, they saw that his countenance was ravaged by starvation. "Get me food," he croaked. "Yes, master," said the machines. "Immediately."
You've just heard the short story, "Who Can Replace a Man?" read by the author Brian W. Aldiss. Recorded at WBAI in April of 1975 on Hour of the Wolf, 5:30 in the morning. My notes here indicate produced and directed by myself, Jim Freund. And this is Hour of the Wolf in a slightly different version of that same radio program, and it is still, in fact, WBAI. I'm so pleased that tape ran through without any troubles. It was, those who were listening very, very carefully to the tonality may have noticed Brian's voice slowing down just a tiny bit toward the end from the tension of the tape recorder. But, hey, it held together, and I'm pleased because I have, as I said, a lot of reel-to-reel media that need to be digitized. And the mere fact of broadcasting it digitizes it. So, well, that's a good thing. Let's see. We actually have 45 minutes. And at this point, I'm quite willing to be freeform and take phone calls and stuff like that. I do have some announcements to make. There are a lot of great readings coming up. There was one earlier tonight at the KGB Fantastic Fiction Series, which I'm very sorry I did not get to. On about May 6th will be Paolo Bacigalupi and N.K. Jemison, as hosted by Tempest Bradford at Word Books. As we get closer to that date, I will tell you more about it. I just saw here an announcement that at the St. Mark's Bookshop on Monday, April 23rd, Samuel R. Delaney, the great, the wonderful, incredible Chip Delaney, will be reading from his new novel, Through the Valley of the Nest of Spiders, will I make a point of being at that. So that's Monday at 7 o'clock at St. Mark's Bookshop. And I have to get in touch with Chip. I was not aware that he was doing the rounds. And it's been a while since he's been on this program, to the point where hasn't been on this show in its new time slot. He was one of the first people I ever met and worked for at WBAI when I came here in 1967. He was producing his radio drama, The Star Pit. On May 1st, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which I produce and host, will feature two wonderful writers, Michael Sisko, who is a teacher of all kinds of things, but a writer as well of dark fantasy and horror fiction, and I guess The Divinity Student remains his best-known work, best-regarded work, perhaps. And with him, coming in from the West Coast, John Shirley, who is wonderful and bizarre fantasy writer of many novels, including his trilogy called The Song Called Youth, which includes Eclipse, one of his best-known books. He wrote the screenplay, The Crow, which was, of course, a cult favorite movie. And he is one of the earliest writers of what people call cyberpunk, as was Rudy Rucker, who we had reading just a couple of months ago. So great thing that they were both able to come in from the West Coast. And then in mid-May, I'm going to be going off to the Science Fiction Writers of America annual Nebula Awards. And I am not a voting member of the Science Fiction Writers. I'm what they call an associate member, which means like publishers or something. You know, I don't write the stuff, but I support the organization and I am a member. And whenever it is in reach, and last year and this year it's been in Washington, D.C. I didn't make it last year. This year I am. I try to do as many interviews as I can do. And the organization has been setting up for me to do interviews. They sent out a thing. And when you sign up to attend the Nebula Awards this year, there's a little checkpoint that says, would you like to be on Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund? He will be recording there. And I thought, okay, that's very cool. And, you know, people will be writing me. And I got email from two people, one of whom is local. So I thought, oh, the hell with that. I'll just have that person, you know, come on the show live. You know, why? But the other person, I thought, you know, okay, You know, well, I'll get an interview out of it. I'll stroll the hallways and I'll find people and I'll say, hey, come over here. I got a cassette recorder just waiting for you. Actually, it's digital, but you know the idea. But what I hadn't figured on was that the other choice there that said, do you want to be, there was either you could write Jim@ourwolf.com and arrange for an interview, which is how I got those two, or you can click here and we'll let him know. And then about 2 weeks ago, I got the spreadsheet from them. 37 people. So I will be in Washington in mid-May recording 37 interviews for this program. Now, given how often we pitch, that's more than a year's worth of shows. So we're going to figure out just how we're going to do this. Obviously, some internet will be involved. Some podcasting will be taking place. So stay tuned for details on that. But other people would be totally daunted. And I'm just excited. I'm thrilled. This is going to be a lot of fun. And we're going to get a lot of great shows out of that. So there we go. If you would like to call up and discuss the fields of science fiction, fantasy, or geekdom in general, that's D-O-M, not D-U-M-B, supposed to dumb geeks, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Nobody should call up and ask me what I thought of the movie Cabin in the Woods because I don't see gory films. It sounds like a lot of fun. I'm aware of all the spoilers and everything in it, but I just don't go in. I don't care that it's written by Joss Whedon and that it's got all this clever, wonderful stuff. It's a gore fest. I don't watch gornography. So, there. Too bad. It sounds like I would enjoy the film if it weren't for the fact that I couldn't watch it. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello. It's you.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm here. I'm calling from Brooklyn.
Very good.
I'm a musician, and I love electronics. And I lie them at night sometimes before I sleep and think of things what I can do to improve my sound. Or the sound of the equipment, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And listening to your program, it was so interesting. You know, see the machines talking to themselves. And right now we do have machines talking to themselves, but we don't realize it.
Mm-hmm.
The computers, they do talk to themselves.
They do, absolutely.
You see, and people don't realize that.
Yeah.
My wife says, you shouldn't let your right hand know what your left hand knows. That's a quote from the Bible, the scriptures. But in these days of computer, anything you do is known. You cannot hide it from the world.
I
want to put in there.
Well, I think there are ways that you can, but it helps to be computer literate.
Yes. And, you know, the older people who are going, like me, I'm 71.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to keep up to date. Many of the people who are as old as I am don't know anything about computer.
Yeah.
About electronics on the whole. Some people can't even turn on a TV. You know, as just a button to press.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's a very sad thing when computer discussions. Before there was the internet, or before the internet was being used by private people, there were bulletin board systems in the early 1980s, and I was very, very active in those. And I tried to work with libraries and old age homes and stuff to get computers with bulletin board systems set up for older people and to train people, particularly older people, so that because I always thought that computers as a medium, as a discussion medium, would be particularly great. And And there is absolutely no reason why older people shouldn't be taking full advantage of computer technology as a social medium.
I agree with that. The same way how they play games, like they go and they play bingo, they play this, they play that.
Mm-hmm.
They should have computer as an item.
As an item and as a game. I mean, computer games are a wonderful thing. Yeah.
Yes. You see?
Yeah.
They just don't do it. The people who are in charge are not pushing it.
I agree. I couldn't get funding. I couldn't get support. I contacted any number of places that had programs for the elderly. And when I tried to describe what it is that, at the time, nobody knew about social media.
Yes. They prefer to know that they buy a pack of cards.
Exactly.
Or a pack of dominoes.
Yeah. It was just,
education.
Yeah. Yeah, they weren't interested in broadening anybody's horizons. They were more interested in containing people.
You know, something happened to a friend of mine a year or so ago. She went to the home, to the where they go every day.
Mm-hmm.
And some lawyer came and spoke and said, after a certain age, you shouldn't own property.
Damn.
She went home. She had a lovely house in Canarsie.
Mm-hmm.
She was a nurse, RN, and she built a lovely home, furnished and everything. She went home, she got her papers, and she put in her son's hand, transfer everything to the son. Within a couple of months, the son sold the property.
No.
Took her to the Poconos, give her a lovely apartment. The apartment is well, comfortable. But then she's buried there. She can't come out and catch a bus or a car and go to her friends. You see?
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Away. So this is where we let our elders down.
Yeah, yeah. And people, the what is defined as elderly? When I was growing up, I am now elderly by the lights of when I was a kid, when I was 5 years old. I'm now 58.
You're a little boy too.
I would have been considered elderly now.
Yes.
To me, I have more than a couple of friends who are 90 years old.
Uh-huh.
And some of them aren't elderly.
That's it.
You know, people really have to rethink their
age.
Yeah.
Age.
Yeah. I really
you
yeah.
to put a limit on your since you're 60 year old.
Yeah. Exactly.
And this should not be, you know. I heard them speaking of mothers. No woman should be a mother over 30 or 35.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a mother, one of my children's mother, who was 47 when she got that child.
Yeah.
And now my daughter is in the American Air Force.
Very good.
She's a computer analyst in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
You see?
Yeah.
And she was born from a mother who was 47 years old. Nothing wrong with her.
Exactly.
So the doctors do mislead the public at times.
Yeah, they are the mis. Sometimes they mislead, and sometimes they just don't get it.
They don't know,
and that's I think that's more to the point. They mislead because they're ignorant.
They don't know. Yes. Yeah. Thank you for taking me, man.
Thank
and
you.
Keep the good program up.
Okay. Thanks so much for being there.
Have a good day.
You too. Take care now. Good morning. And hi there, you're on the radio. Whoops, no, you're not. I mean, you are, but you're a dial tone. Good morning, you're on the air.
Good morning, James.
Good morning, Robert.
How art thou?
Art okay.
Yes. Just think, though, you have 17 years to wait before the restrictions on you are eased at airports about shoes and hats.
Yeah, how about that?
Apparently, they're lifting it at 75. I only have 8.
Yeah, but they might change that in the meantime. So they'll make it 85 at that point. So.
Please, that tape for 37-year tape that held up remarkably well.
Yeah,
and I have to say, it caused me to think. If I reach my hand out, I have a shelf of reel-to-reel tapes, and one of them, the one that sits on top, is the one that Baird Searles made or he made it on reel-to-reel tape in those days, of the poetry and the music of The Lord of the Rings.
Of Middle-earth, not of The Lord of the Rings.
And that had to be...
But you have a copy, because I have the master.
Oh, okay.
I have all of Baird's tapes.
I mean, that had to be...
I literally inherited them, so...
I would love to know if he ever taped any of his of Unicorns and Universes shows.
I have a few of them, yeah.
Because that's where he actually read from things like Alan Garner's.
Well, no. Remember, if Unicorns and Universes was a 25-minute show. So he did only short things on there. That was a review show. Otherwise, remember, he was the drama and literature director.
Right.
So he just had these things on the air. They weren't as part of regular show. In case you've forgotten, I was Baird's intern.
I vaguely remember.
Yeah, that's what I did here. So,
then he must have done another literary show.
He did many.
Because I remember him reading
He was the DNL director. And in those days, drama and literature was a major part of this radio station. He was on the air with different things every day, of Unicorns and Universes, which was him and Neil Conan and occasionally Mike Hodel, was on weekly. When Baird left here in 1970, I replaced... of Unicorns and Universes went away, and I started a review program that was 15 minutes long called The Great Intergalactic Collective Participatory Review. And that was my take on Of Unicorns and Universes.
Well,
of which I was on once and only once.
But as I say, that to me, that was the halcyon days. I mean, I would come back, and I believe it was on Fridays or some. I would rush back from high school or somewhere. No, I was actually, if it was 70s, I was already graduating.
Well, he left in 1970.
But so. I do remember rushing back to hear some of the things that he did.
Yeah. And by the way, for the record, the producer of Songs and Poems from Middle Earth was Martin Last, Baird's lover.
Oh, well, it was an interesting program because, of course, he read... poems and the songs, but with musical accompaniments, in the sense of he did things
he
like...
He played records in the background.
Obanis and
yeah.
A lot of composers. And it was just it was just when I really began to understand how much the Middle Earth mythos was a singing world.
Yes, very much so. And that is my greatest criticism of the movies. Is that I remember an interview with Peter Jackson before the first film came out, and what he and a lot of the people involved in the making of the Lord of the Rings movie said, oh, yeah, we definitely got the culture in there. We have, you know, there's a difference between the elves in Rivendell and the elves in here and all that. And I thought, no, I'm sorry, you don't have the culture. They have maybe the beginning of The Road Goes Ever On, and by the way, with the wrong tune, in the background and the beginning of the movie, and there is no song or epic poetry in the rest of the 12 hours of the extended edition.
With the exception of that party scene with Bilbo's 111th birthday, there is a musical interlude, it's sort of instrumental. The only singing that I remember, and I've got a pretty good memory for this sort of thing, is when Pippin is singing to Denethor. And that's about the only music that I remember.
Yeah, well, there's that, and there is The Road Goes Ever On, very briefly.
I don't even remember where that was.
And right in the beginning, as the Fellowship departs, Hobbiton.
Oh, okay. Now, is it true that you mentioned when you talked about The Hobbit coming on December 14th, I believe is a release date, that there will be more music in this?
I have no idea.
Oh, because I thought somebody mentioned that there would be. I certainly hope so.
Well, given that they haven't finished post-production on the film, anybody who said anything is a bit premature.
The movie isn't finished yet?
No. This is April, and the movie comes out in December.
Oh, well, I figured it was already in the can. No,
they finished filming.
Oh.
They're in post-production.
One last question. Are you doing any readings after May for NERSIF? Anything in June?
We do, of course, first Tuesday of every month.
All right. All right, well.
I can already tell you that one of the two readers in June will be Nora Jemison, and I don't know who the other is, and I may not decide until like a week or two before, because that's the same week that BEA, the Book Expo, is in town. And so with all these writers coming to New York, I may play footloose and fancy free and see who I can book last minute.
And who did you say was going to be Nursa for May, or don't we know yet?
May 1st, as I just announced.
Yes, you did, yes.
And then May 23rd, we're going to be doing a special edition, or May 22nd, rather, which will be curated by Liz Gorinsky, and the readers will be Charlie Jane Anders and Brian Francis Slattery.
Ah, very good.
So we're going to have three in a period of 4 weeks.
Okay.
So we're running hot and heavy.
Good luck.
Okay, thanks. Take care. And good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there. Turn down your radio. Hello? Yeah, I can hear the person in the background.
Oh, hello. Dr. Maria?
Yes.
Oh, it's ironic that I say...
Okay.
I say machines more than people. Like, for instance, get a job, they will go to your Facebook, look up your record, you know, and other things like, for instance, the pacemaker, so on and so on. We don't have that human contact anymore. It seems like we're so fragmented.
Mm-hmm.
And where do that leave us? Do we need the machine, or do the machine need us?
Well, I mean, one of the, you know, I would actually argue that as much as I dislike a lot of what's going on in social networks and how people use them, that there is actually more contact that people have with each other than they did in the previous 20 years. That people have been becoming more, because of media like television, less social. And that computer media actually make people more social.
I would say yes and no, but then it become more, I would say, clannish, like, you know, tribalism, like,
mm-hmm.
If you don't belong to this group, in this group, you know, it's no more of a, I can't say, a secular thing, a unity thing. It's more, it's like you say, it brings more people, but it still separates.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I think that's also a part of human nature. I think that when you go to, a convention, a gathering of people, a large gathering of people, people club together in that same manner anyway. You know, in other words, I agree with what you're saying, but I think that's got a lot to do with human nature rather than technology.
You know, I say that too, because that reminds me of overthrow Wall Street incident, like that one majority has, you know, and then there's the 99%, whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
For example, right there, you know, there's more people, but yet they don't have, how can I say, they have the power.
But I think you used the word earlier, unity.
Unity, right, there you go.
And I think that you're quite right about that. But it's just that I wouldn't blame technology for it. I think that we simply see it reflected.
Oh, I would say yes, they use technology because, how you say, weaponry and so on, they, by enforcing so-called laws,
mm-hmm.
they use, what, guns? Like, look around the world. What are they using? Weapons, like over in, what is it, Iran? Or is it,
you've lost me here. What does that have to do with unity and...
Oh, no, control. Machines. Same principle. A weapon is a machine.
Well, not necessarily. Many machines are weapons, but weapons are not necessarily machines. A spear is not a machine.
Well, you can use it as a machine. I say a tool. Put that, all right, a tool. Is a machine a tool? Will.
Can be, not necessarily.
Okay, I say we're like...
And if in fact, a great example was the short story that we just played earlier, the Brian Aldiss story.
That was beautiful. I like that now, where man at the end said, well, feed me.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, remind me of a plantation scenery. Yeah, be yourself, you're good.
Okay, thanks so much.
Don't think about getting old. You never get old. You get good like wine.
Then why is this time turned to surgery, you know?
Well, yeah. But I guess I need to be rotated every few months.
All right, there you go.
Okay, thanks so much. Take care. Okay.
All right.
Good, you too. Thanks. Bye-bye. Telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hi there.
Hi. How are you?
I'm okay. Turn down your radio.
Okay. 1 second.
Yeah, I have to tell that to everybody. Remember, when you're calling, turn down your radio because we are on delay, and it's very confusing to you and to us. And I'm always confused.
Okay, sorry.
How are you?
Just good, good. Just for argument's sake, if social networks compensate for the isolation that television caused, then how about people who have neither?
Well, people who have neither very often tend to be more social. They tend to go out and meet people.
There you go, and call radio programs.
Yeah, well, there's that, isn't there? Yeah, but radio is also, you know, before television, is also one of the great isolators. Not so much anymore.
Very true. It depends how long you keep it on.
Yes, and we know that there are people who keep it on, you know, every waking moment. You know, the great late Monroe Littman never wasn't listening to WBAI, and I often suspect that when he woke up, he would check archives and stuff like that to find out what he had missed. And I know that there are people who, through the years, and I've been volunteering here since 1967, there have been people who totally isolated themselves in the world of this particular radio station.
I don't think that's very healthy.
No, I think it's practice. I must agree with you.
You know, I parse my radio very, very carefully, and in fact, it's quite an accident that I got to hear your show tonight.
Ah,
and I also. I don't know if you want me to say that, but I do switch stations. I don't just listen to BAI, you know. I generally throughout the day.
I would hope so. I mean, I will admit to people I don't only read science fiction books, you know.
Right. No, I mean, you know, there are other great radio programs on other stations.
There are.
New York has got some of the best radio anywhere.
But I know of. One of the things that is so great about internet technology is that by using it, this is better than shortwave was. You can hear pretty much any radio station anywhere in the world
by using the
internet.
I'm not a Buddhist at all.
So,
I'm just very different of the. In fact, I am talking to you from my computer.
Mm-hmm, yeah, I can actually hear the sound of a computer phone call. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's on Gmail. If you have a Gmail account, you can call for free anywhere in the U.S. and Canada.
Yeah, using Google Voice. I love Google Voice. I'm a big fan of it.
And you know, so I'm not a Luddite. I do not dislike computers. I think that people, you know, tend to be lazy, and the social networks make you lazier.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do exactly the same things that you would do on a social network, except you're not hooked and you're not disemboweled publicly, you know, with all your information on all sorts of, you know, data lists.
Yeah.
Just using email and doing what you would do on your wall on Facebook, you can do it on your website.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even that hard to make a website anymore, if it ever was.
Oh, it never was. It's always been easy to make a website. In fact, I think they've made it harder in more recent times by adding CSS and stuff like that. But there are a lot of good tools out there that you can use on your own computer, and there are a lot of good free tools, including, I don't want to say one brand over another. There's one called Wombly. There's Google Sites. And I'm not talking about blogs. I'm talking about actual websites and free software. And I personally am a great advocate of websites over blogs and over social networks.
Oh, we're on the same page then.
I guess so.
I guess you know, the social networks can be a crutch for people to get away from their couch if they're watching TV. But
they're fun. I mean, they really are fun, but also in limited doses. I have a Facebook. There is a Facebook group for Hour of the Wolf. There is a Facebook group for my reading series, New York Review of Science Fiction. I, of course, have a wall there. I also have all of this above on Google+. And so forth. But frankly, I really try to keep my time on those limited. I am not on social networks more than about 90 minutes a week. I spend more time, trying to do web work.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Although I must say my website is woefully out of date. But I'm, my big push at this point is I'm trying to get a podcast out there. Weekly podcast. Okay.
Well, I must admit one thing, though, about Twitter. It's good for political activity. I recently posted on an hashtag in Italy, they basically, we complain about here, but in Italy, if you own a radio or a TV station, you have to pay every year a license to the national broadcast company.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pay for renewal, if you want to live by the law.
Yeah.
And recently, the local national broadcasting company has tried to say that since you can get TVs on computers and smartphones, you should be taxed for those too.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there was a revolution that lasted a couple of days until they withdrew the proposal. But during those 2 days, I posted to this hashtag that I read on a newspaper on the web edition, and I said, make February 29th the no TV day, so they'll get the message. If everybody in the country turns their TV set off, they will really give them a feel of what could happen. Now, I don't know if that happened. I'm pretty sure it didn't. I did get a lot of feedback, though.
I don't know. I think every February 29th, people should go see a Gilbert and Sullivan show.
Sounds good. Let's make that the Gilbert and Sullivan day.
Absolutely. Well, there should be more than, once every 4 years. But since Gilbert and Sullivan have a song about February 29th in the Pirates of Penzance.
What is it called?
It's called A Paradox. Well, the show is The Pirates of Penzance.
Oh, I see. Okay. I remember when I first arrived in this country, it was on Broadway, The Pirates of Penzance.
Yeah, not my favorite production of it, I must say. I did not approve of the Joe Papp production. It had its moments, but it's not true Gilbert and Sullivan.
Well, my experiences on Broadway have been dreadful, except for one occasion. My system shuts down, although I do like good theater, but in my opinion, good theater is the most difficult thing to achieve.
Well, it's great art. I've done a little work in the theater.
You have?
Yes, I have. I've produced 3 shows, and I'm a great advocate of theater,
so am I.
Yeah,
but it's really hard. It's hard to make good theater.
It is. It's tough work, but when it happens, it is the greatest form of entertainment, I believe.
I agree. But I could probably quote, and I've seen quite a few productions. I can remember maybe on the point of one hand's fingers when I really saw good theater in my entire life.
Well, I've seen more than that. I'm.
Then you're luckier.
No, maybe so. Maybe so.
Yes. Maybe you've seen a lot more than I have too. Probably.
Maybe so. Could well be. There was 1 year in which I was, in fact, working for. I had a computer job working for a company that did a certain amount of ticketing, and in that show, it was our job to see every show that was opening up Broadway and off Broadway. And in that year, I went. I didn't catch every show. I went to over 70. I was going to more than a show a week, and I saw more bad theater that year than I cared to name. But some of it was good. Some of it was very good. I remember also, now I'm forgetting the name of the play. It was a Jean Genet show. It starred Jude Law and Kathleen Turner. I think Cynthia Nixon was in it. It was an incredible cast. That was great theater. My favorite theater tends to be written by Tom Stoppard, I must say. But then again, you know, it depends on the production.
Have you seen that production of Little Ham that they had in this little theater on the south side of 42nd Street?
No, I have not.
That was really superlative. And, mm-hmm. and the other thing that I do recall was... the Bleecker Street Theater, when it was working as such.
Oh, yes.
It was a thing called RFK. It was a one-man show. Mm-hmm. It was truly amazing. These are the two most recent things, which means within the last decade, maybe decade and a half.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there's always a lot of great theater out there. The trick isn't finding it. I know I can say that for those, by the way, who are fans of science fiction and fans of theater, there will be a major event coming up this summer off-Broadway of a theater production of a novel by Ursula K. Le Guin, The Lathe of Heaven. So people should look forward for that. And as we know more, I will tell people more.
Oh, good. Well, since you are a science fiction person, have you ever seen Galaxy Quest?
Yeah, sure.
What do you think of it?
I thought it was very amusing.
Oh, it's a fantastic movie. And I, again, you know, like on your show, I should have sort of happened on it by mistake.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to Europe and... I could see that on the flight they were going to have the new 007 movie, and I got excited, not because I'm a fan, but on a flight sometime before I had seen Tomorrow Never Dies, which in my opinion is the best 007 ever. So I thought, not so bad. Maybe I should see the next one.
Well, I have to say the best 007 movie, whatever it will have to star Sean Connery, and after that, Daniel Craig. But but Pierce Brosnan was okay.
I'm partial to Pierce. I really liked him in Tomorrow Never Dies.
He was very good. I liked that one. I did like that one. Yeah. But you know,
I was disappointed.
But I'm of an age where Sean Connery is the defining person.
I know, and you know, there are different schools of thought about that. I mean, the predominant is yours, but I really think that Pierce Brosnan was the best.
He was very good. He got gypped, though. He should have been Bond 15 years earlier, but he was caught in a contract dispute with NBC. At the time, he was working on a TV series, and they would not release him to do movies. And so he came to Bond, and that was, I think that's when it went to Timothy Dalton. And Dalton didn't do a bad job, but damn it, that was the time for Pierce Brosnan to have taken over the role, and he got gypped. But I like Brosnan. Okay.
That one movie that Timothy Dalton did was such a dud, though.
He did two movies, not one.
He did two?
He did two.
Well, then, who is the other guy who did one? The one where he gets married and then...
George Lazenby.
Oh, okay, yes. Then that's the worst one.
No, it's not the worst. I could re-edit that film if I was an editor and make it very good. It's very simple. Cut out the entire snow sequence. But remember, remember that one has the best Bond, if you'll pardon the expression, Bond girl of them all, and that's Diana Rigg.
Oh,
Diana.
I will always remember her as the Avenger.
Of course, Of course, and as
will everybody.
As should everybody. Unfortunately, nowadays, when most people say the Avengers, they mean a Marvel comic or that movie that's going to be opening up. But the Avengers was one of my favorite TV shows, and Diana Rigg, one of the great, great, great TV heroines, and she was fine in Bond.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she was.
And she was in that movie with George Lazenby. So before people discard that film, if people went back and looked at that carefully, it had some problems. But it is far, far from being the worst Bond film.
And so what do you think is the worst?
I wouldn't say it's any one, but several of the movies starring Roger Moore were pretty bad.
Oh, yes, I agree.
Some of them are fun, but many of them are bad.
I haven't seen all of them simply because I won't watch more.
Yeah. And I thought, by the way, the third version of Casino Royale, the one with Daniel Craig, I thought that was pretty darned good.
Yeah, I must say that I was impressed. You know, I was a little disappointed that Jude Law didn't get the job.
I'm not quite sure if he would have been right. I wish we had the time, but we don't. But I'll tell you my nominee for the next Bond, after Daniel Craig is done, an actor named Adrian Lester.
Hmm.
If you've ever seen the TV series Hustle.
No, I don't have a TV, so it would be quite hard.
And it's not broadcast in America anyway. It's a British show, but I'll tell you this: he's black, but he's right for the part. He would make a great, great James Bond.
That would be groundbreaking, and probably will happen at some point.
It should.
In fact, I think they were considering a black candidate this time around as well.
I think it was possible. I am out of time.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much. It was fun talking with you.
Thank you. Likewise. I wish you had more time.
Okay. All the best.
Okay. You too. Take care. Good morning.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And, okay. I try to be dramatic and double-click, but wrong pot. There we go. Okay. So, thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I will be back next week from 1:30 until 3 a.m. Wednesday night, Thursday morning. It will be a little less freeform than this week, but I can't yet tell you what it will be. Well, as mentioned before, join the Facebook group if you like. Go to Facebook and look up Hour of the Wolf, not the movie. You can do that too. It's a great movie. But the group referring to the radio show, and you can keep up with things there. Also, the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, or just write me, Jim. At OurWolf.com, HOURWOLF. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn, Clappers with Lister. Records being organized even as we speak. Take care and have a wonderful week. Yes, and I forgot to mention, visit the website, OurWolf.com. It's, well, old-looking, but it's valid. Good morning.
Like it. on my lips. I am a rebel spirit. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
best.
The red, white, and blue stood on you.
We want no dinner.